Not only has Seymour Stein signed and nurtured more important artists than anyone alive, he's still the hippest record label head in the business. He recorded, he founded Sire Records since the late 1950s. Seymour has been wherever it's happening. The Brill Building for the teams of songwriters, London for the British Invasion, CBGB for the birth of punk, clubs like Danceteria and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. All along the way, he's discovered artists like the Ramones, who we just heard, as well as Talking Heads, The Pretenders, Madonna, The Replacements, Katie Lang, Depeche Mode, The Smiths, The Cure, and the list goes on and on. He also signed established stars like Lou Reed, Brian Wilson. He just wrote a new memoir with Gareth Murphy called Siren Song, My Life in Music. It's published by St. Martin Press. Welcome.
Well, glad to be here.
So in the book, you write about when you first heard the Ramones in the summer of 1975 at a rehearsal you'd arranged. You describe their sound as, and this is a quote from your book, the filthiest sugar and the sugariest filth you had ever tasted, saying that it was a clear-cut case of sign now, make sense of it later. At the time of giant rock dinosaurs and at the height of disco, what turned you on about this band? And with their leather jackets and torn jeans and one-minute songs, didn't make sense.
Well, that was superfluous. The leather jackets, it was great. The torn jeans was great, but there was nothing else, there was nothing like them around, you know. And that's what I look for, you know, something new. I don't chase sound-alike artists, you know, like some people do. I try to find the most unique, and they certainly fit the bill. Talking Heads fit the bill. The Pretenders, when I first saw them, Madonna, there was nothing like any of them, you know. But I think that particularly the Ramones, I mean, never been and probably never will be anything like the Ramones again.
What's the sense that you use? What are you tuning into when you meet somebody, meet an artist?
Well, with every artist or band, it's always been about the songs. I mean, I'm a song person. I don't play an instrument. I don't write. I can't write a song. You know, I'm not a musician. I'm not a producer. If I have anything, it's ears, and I've used my ears. I started listening to the radio when I was about 5 or 6 years old. We grew up in Brooklyn, and I lived with my sister and my parents in a 2-bedroom apartment. I shared a bedroom with my sister, who's 6 years older than me, and thanks to her, I got into music very, very early.
What were some of the first records that inspired you?
Oh, God. Well, inspired me to really go in, you know, to see that there was a... I loved everything. I mean, I can remember songs from the 40s, but one of the first songs that I heard that I knew there was a change coming was when I heard The Fat Man by Fats Domino. I'd never heard anything like it. Then when I started hearing country and western songs on the radio, most of them were cover records, like The Tennessee Waltz by Patti Page, or all the other Hank Williams songs that came after that. I knew that there was a change coming, and then when I heard Doo-Wop, G by the Crows, Hearts of Stone by Otis Williams and the Charms and stuff like that, Shaboom by the Chords, I mean, it was in the air,
So you knew that change was coming, but when did you decide to be a part of that change? When did you know I'm going to be in the music industry?
Well, I always wanted to know more about the music business. I started keeping track of the Billboard charts. I would listen every Saturday to the, they played the top 25. Martin Block was a disc jockey. And, and I went up to Billboard, and I wanted to go even further back than when I was keeping the charts. But Billboard was in the Palace Theater building, and that was, you know, ground zero. All the indie labels were based around there. Three of the four majors at the time had offices near there, RCA, Columbia, and Decca. Capitol was the only one based in L.A. And I realized, why am I going backwards? I should be going forward. And, you know, Paul Ackerman at Billboard and Tom Noonan at Billboard, they helped me meet people. The most important person I met in my life was Sid Nathan from King Records, who saw something special in me and brought me out to Cincinnati when I was quite young over the summers.
And that was the entryway for you?
To teach me the business. But I got to know Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler from Atlantic, and Ahmet's brother Nesui, Lou Chud from Imperial, and the Chess Brothers and all of that. I mean, it was just a fabulous experience for me and many others.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Seymour Stein, the founder of Siren Records, discussing his memoir, Siren Song, My Life in Music. So let's get to Siren Records, this massive thing that you created. When did you get the idea? When did this all start?
Well, I worked for Billboard, then I worked for King Records, and then I came back to New York from Cincinnati and wound up working in the Brill Building for Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller and George Goldner at Redbird Records. That's where I met Richard Goddard. Mm. And we decided to start a production company, which then led into the record label, Sire Records. And
Were you nervous? Were you always as confident as you are now?
I'm still very nervous, you know, and, you know, I mean, it's, look, it's, you know, but I love every minute of it. Not every minute, but pretty much of it.
So what made you transform Sire into an independent record label?
Well, that was the next step, you know, and I had met people over the years that had promised to help me if I ever started a label, and one of them was the chairman of EMI Records, L.G. Wood. And on my first trip to London, I met him. And I remember the Beatles were dismissed by Capitol, who was supposed to put them out, not once, but twice.
What a miscalculation.
So, yes, what a So I figured there must be so many other things that that Capitol are not putting out. And that's where I got my earliest releases from, bands like Climax Blues Band, Barclay James Harvest, Renaissance, Kevin Ayers. Also, I got bombarded by EMI's overseas companies. EMI was the biggest record company in the world.
Do I understand it correctly? So you made a lot of your early business from picking up rejects that you recognized were stars?
Well, I didn't. I hoped they were stars, and some of them were, some of them weren't. But the big break came when their Dutch company contacted me and sent me a record by a guy called Jan Akkerman. I fell in love with it. I called him up. I said, look, I can't pay it a big advance. He said, you can have this record for nothing. He just left the label, so there's no follow-up. I said, what is he doing? He said, well, he went back to his group Focus.
Wow.
And I said, oh, my God, this must be fantastic. I got on a plane. Focus were actually playing just to make a living as the band for the Dutch production of Hair. And I met them, I signed them, and eventually the second album became my first million-selling single, Hocus Pocus, and gold album, which sold over 800,000 copies, Moving Waves, the album. That really put us on the map.
Now, what about the Replacements? I know you signed them in the mid-1980s, and some people had high hopes, others didn't. What was your thinking?
I don't care what other people, you know, I met them. I knew they wouldn't be the easiest band to work with, but I liked them so much, both as people and more importantly, their music, that I didn't care.
What made them so tough to work with?
They really weren't. No, not you know, I think they kind of settled down and you know, they're a very, very special band. They keep, but about two or three times I think they've been nominated to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. They haven't made it yet. They will. I think other bands of mine, Depeche Mode, will get in, the Smiths will get in, and four of my artists have already gotten in. Of course, the Ramones, Talking Heads, the Pretenders, and Madonna.
Let's talk about Madonna. You know, one of the famous stories in your book is how you signed a then-unknown Miss Ciccone to a recording contract from a bed at Lenox Hill Hospital.
Yes, yes. I was sick. I was really sick. I had a thing called subacute endocarditis.
Sounds
which,
nasty.
which in those days could only be cured by 28 days in the hospital on a drip. I was about halfway through the drip, and I heard the record and the demo that she made, and I said, oh God, somebody's going to hear this and they're going to sign her. I wanted to come right to the hospital. I called Mark Kamens, who brought her to me, and said, you know, please try to get her here, you know, while I'm here. And he calls me up at 5 o'clock. He says, we're going to be there tonight at 8 o'clock. I was a mess. I had to clean myself up as much as possible. But the minute she walked in, I knew she just wanted somebody to believe in her, to give her that. She believed so strongly in herself, and well, she should, she just wanted that break, and boom, you know, I was able to, you know, to sign her, and you know, and like I say, the rest is history.
I'm trying to picture the scene. I know that you're in a hospital room. Did you have an IV drip? Were you?
I had an IV drip. I had it all. Yeah, absolutely.
You had that robe on where your back was out.
Yeah, no, I was in the bed. I didn't want to. You know, please. she didn't have to look at my tuchus. Please. I was in. No. I had somebody came and cut my hair. I shaved and I was able to, you know, I looked pretty decent. She didn't care. I mean, I'm not saying she didn't care, but I mean, she believed so much in herself, and that made me believe so much in her. And it was only one song, everybody, you know, but I just knew it. I knew it. And I didn't want to wait another 2 weeks till I got out of the hospital because, you know, indies, we have to live in fear that somebody, you know, one of the majors is going to come in and, you know, or for more. I mean, like the first time I saw Talking Heads, which was completely an accident. I mean, it's just the Ramones had booked CBGBs to play me some songs, and the opening act had gotten a gig somewhere else, so I saw Talking Heads, which I had heard about, but I hadn't seen, and they, was one of the truly great moments in my life, hearing the Talking Heads, and it took me 11 and a half months to sign them, and I lost so much sleep. I figured somebody from a major label or from a company larger than Sire, almost every company was larger than Sire that day, is going to, you know, hear this unbelievably commercial and unbelievably unique band and, you know, steal them out from under me before I could sign them. But thank God nobody did.
It seems like your work has really shaped the soundtrack of the last few generations at this point. What do you think about the future? So much is happening with the music industry. Where do you see it, and where do the music men of tomorrow operate?
Well, look, I don't agree with you. There'll always be music. I mean, we can't live without it. Music's been around forever. It's not like movies. It's not like television. It's not like, I mean, there's always been music. There were rock stars 300, 400 years ago. They were called Bach and Beethoven and Tchaikovsky. But their audience was limited to royal families and, you know, very, very wealthy people. You know, thankfully, a lot has changed, particularly it's starting in the late 19th century with Tin Pan Alley in New York and things that were going over in England as well and on the continent. But
what advice do you give them, the future versions of yourself?
Keep your ears open, you know, and, you know, also keep your ears open for something new. Because, you know, I mean, a lot of music is very befitting of the time that it's in, you know, whether it was back during World War One when there were so many war songs that, you know, over there and things like that. Or in the late 20s when kids were starting to go to college in great numbers for the first time, a lot of college songs became number one records. Then you had the big bands, and they had all the big band numbers. And then country music comes in, and rhythm and blues, and all of that. And music is very much tied to the times it's in. And it's very true with rap and hip hop and what's going on over the last 25, 30 years. And it's going to change. It's going to keep changing, you know.
And on that note, we have to end our interview. It's going to keep changing. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you.
And I've been speaking with Seymour Stein about his memoir, Siren Song, My Life in Music.
Caught between the twisted stars, the plotted lines, the faulty map that brought Columbus to New York. Betwixt between the east and west, he calls on her wearing a leather vest. The earth squeals and shudders to a halt. A diamond crucifix in his ear is used to help ward off the fear that he has left his soul in someone's rented car. Inside his pants he hides a mop to clean the mess that he has dropped into the life of lithesome Juliet Bell.